About 100 years ago, around the time of the First World War, there was a growing concern in Britain about working conditions in factories, mines, and elsewhere. Here's how the historian Anthony Wall described working conditions during the Victorian era. For industrial workers, the working day meant early starts, long hours, and often physically demanding labor in conditions that would have challenged even the strongest constitutions. To start work at 6 a.m., perhaps after walking through sleet or rain, and to continue at it all day in overheated, drafty, or ill-ventilated workrooms meant for many a slow process of physical decline or a life lived continuously on the brink of exhaustion. This exhaustion was worrisome for the workers, of course, but also for their employers and for Britain, because exhaustion presumably meant lower productivity, and, well, nobody wanted that.
So Britain forms the Industrial Fatigue Research Board.
That is so British.
Yeah, right? It's soon after the war. And even in its name, you can see the focus is really on fatigue. They're trying to figure out the limitations of assembly line production workers. And kind of early on, they think fatigue is the main limitation.
That's Amanda Markey. We'll meet her more formally in a bit. The Industrial Fatigue Research Board, she tells us, hired a psychologist named Stanley Wyatt.
And for him, he actually starts by looking at how differences in temperature affect productivity.
Wyatt didn't find much there in the temperature idea, so he started talking with assembly line workers about the repetitive tasks they did all day.
And he finds that it's really not fatigue that's the limiting factor of production, it's boredom.
Up to that point, Markey says, the causes and consequences of boredom hadn't really been studied. What effect it might have, for instance, on the economy.
The word boredom actually doesn't even start occurring in the English language until the 18th century. It's pretty late on the scene.
Really?
No, yeah. And once it comes into the language, kind of quickly takes off. And it comes with the rise of industrialization and also with the rise of leisure time. So there's kind of like a burst of research at the very beginning on assembly line workers looking at boredom, but then funding dries up and, unsurprising, so does the research.
Amanda Markey is so interested in boredom that she wrote her PhD dissertation in economics on the topic.
There were still a lot of gaps in the literature.
So, on this episode of Freakonomics Radio...
Boredom.
Boredom?
Boredom. The concept of boredom.
Is boredom somehow an economic concept?
Boredom is a way to signal that you're mismanaging scarce resources. And of course, scarcity is just at the foundation of economics.
Is there perhaps an upside to boredom?
Boredom is useful because you don't want an organism who just does the same thing over and over again without learning anything.
And if I ask you to just sit there for a while and do nothing but think, will you get bored? And what will you do to alleviate that boredom?
An astounding percentage of people hate sitting there thinking so much that they'll start shocking themselves.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio, the show that explores the hidden side of everything. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Amanda Markey did not mean to get bit by the boredom bug.
This is kind of embarrassing as a boredom researcher, but I'm hardly ever bored.
While studying behavioral economics at Carnegie Mellon University, Markey was looking around for a research topic.
And our professor, George Loewenstein, was listing a series of topics he felt like hadn't gotten enough attention.
Things like privacy, or the way some people collect expertise about something like wine the way other people collect physical goods, and also boredom.
And the more I looked into it, the more I found it was really fertile ground.
These days, Amanda Markey makes her living as an algebra teacher in New York City, which, depending on how you feel about algebra, makes her an automatic boredom expert. In any case, the fact is that psychologists have yet to really land on a clear, universally accepted definition of boredom and what causes it. Is it a lack of novelty, the absence of meaningful engagement, or maybe it's a somewhat useful dormant state? But here's what experts do know about boredom.
Okay, so there are two types of boredom. There's trait boredom and state boredom.
State boredom is being bored in the moment, as in, this movie is boring. This party is boring. And then there's trait boredom.
Trait boredom is the question of, are you the type of person who's likely to experience boredom?
That is, are you someone who's routinely bored no matter what you're doing? Again, Markey points out that boredom research isn't all that far along, but earlier studies have at least shown that boredom is associated with a lot of negative things.
Boredom is associated with depression. It's associated with loneliness, gambling, drinking, dropping out of school.
Now, saying that boredom is associated with those things doesn't tell us if boredom causes them. It could be that loneliness is boring, that depression is boring, that you get bored once you drop out of school. There is, however, some evidence to suggest that people really can't stand to be bored. Hi, Dan Gilbert.
Dan Gilbert here. Stephen?
Dan Gilbert is a Harvard psychology professor. He mentioned some research he had conducted on the disengaged mind.
If you're interested in boredom, you might be interested in an article that Tim Wilson and I published in Science.
Here's what Gilbert and Wilson wanted to know. When people find themselves with nothing to do but think, have to entertain themselves with their own thoughts, is that a pleasant experience? To find out, the researchers recruited 55 undergrads, male and female. They put them in an unadorned room, one at a time, and exposed them to a variety of positive and negative stimuli. A recording of guitar music, for instance. A color photograph of a cockroach. And a mild, but still quite painful, electric shock.
Ah!
The participants were then told to imagine they'd been given $5. Then they were asked whether they'd pay some of that money to not receive the shock again. The vast majority of them, 42 of the 55 students, said they would pay to not be shocked. And then, Gilbert says, each of those 42 students was left alone by themselves in this unadorned room.
And you tell them their job is just to think.
But if they wanted to, at any point, they could shock themselves again.
And it turns out that an astounding percentage of people hate sitting there thinking so much that they'll start shocking themselves.
One participant shocked himself 190 times in 15 minutes. Now, granted, this was a very small and narrow experiment, but let's assume we take its findings at face value, that having nothing to do but think is so unpleasant that some people would rather inflict pain on themselves to relieve their, well, this is another assumption, but let's say it, to relieve their boredom. If that's the case, I know, if, but remember, it's still early days in boredom research. If that is the case, Amanda Markey wondered, why have humans evolved with this peculiar emotion?
Most emotions in the world tell you direct your attention to something, even if it's something negative, right? Even like disgust says, this is really important, direct your attention. Boredom is really one of the few and maybe even the only emotions that says, this isn't a good use of your time, direct your attention to something else, like get out of this situation.
Markey and her professor, George Lowenstein, wondered if economics might have some explanation for why we get bored. They came up with what Lowenstein calls the scarce capacity theory of boredom.
So you have mental resources, they're scarce and they're really important and valuable, and boredom develops as the signal that mental resources are not being used wisely. They're not being used on valuable pursuits. And a lot of this was based on, I think you spoke with Angela Duckworth.
We did speak with Angela Duckworth. She is a psychology professor at the University of Pennsylvania with a focus on education. Duckworth used to be, like Amanda Markey is now, a school teacher.
I taught math, yeah.
Duckworth and some colleagues created a model for thinking about emotions that might help explain boredom.
If you ask a simple question, why we have emotions, the answer seems to be that evolution gave us emotions for survival. So fear is useful, anxiety is useful, and even boredom is useful because you don't want an organism who just does the same thing over and over again without learning anything. It would be good to equip that organism with an emotion, an urge to move on when they don't think that they're learning anything new.
The argument is that we're constantly doing a sort of cost-benefit analysis of how to spend our mental energy. Consider a student in the classroom bored.
My guess about boredom is that the thought that kind of goes through a kid's head, whether it be conscious or not, is the idea that I am not learning anything right now that I care about. And so I think actually kids are in a way like little economists who are weighing the costs and benefits of what they're doing. And when the calculus seems to favor not paying attention to what the teacher's saying or not doing their homework, then that's what they do. I think in a way they're very rational.
The premise of that theory is that boredom is a way to signal that you're mismanaging scarce resources.
That's Amanda Markey again.
And of course, scarcity is just at the foundation of economics. They actually also say that how you judge the value of what you're doing is not only based on what you're doing, but it's also based on opportunity cost.
As in, there are other more interesting, more valuable things I could be doing with my time. Markey and her colleagues wanted to test this scarce capacity theory. First, they needed a reliable way to induce boredom in the laboratory.
So our first challenge was just having something to give lab participants in order to make them bored.
In earlier boredom studies, Markey says, researchers came up with makeshift ways to bore the participants. You'd have to write the same two letters of the alphabet over and over, or watch a video of people doing their laundry.
And none had really been validated to ensure that they actually do induce boredom, and also, really importantly, don't induce other emotions, because you don't want a task that induces both boredom and anger.
So Markey and her fellow researchers came up with a series of boring-seeming tasks and began testing them to find the boringest of the boring.
Which was fun because everyone has an opinion on the most boring situation. And one guy in the lab meeting said the worst job he ever had was working at a bank and having to match signatures. And he said it was just the worst job because they always matched. So we did a signature matching task based off of his experience.
I have to say, when I tried your signature matching task, I got so bored that I stopped. Markey and her team even produced their own boring video.
I've been asked to tell you about my day yesterday.
They hired an actor to play the part of an office worker who sells cardstock.
I guess it's important to let you know that I work for a company that orders office supplies for other companies. And
it was a pretty low-budget production. He talks about his day and what he had for breakfast and how cardstock prices are controlled by the weather.
Oh, really? See, I'm super interested in that somehow. Cardstock prices are controlled by the weather because of tree growth or something, or pulping, or manufacture?
I don't think we did any homework whatsoever to look at the validity. And then we thought maybe the video would be too interesting because you'd have this person to look at, so we also did an audio version to see if radio was particularly boring.
And which induced more boredom, the video of the cardstock script or the audio of the cardstock script?
You know what? Slightly more for the video, but not significantly different.
But audio is slightly less boring than video, you're saying?
I am saying that.
This is good news for those of us who make audio. You realize the ammunition you're giving us here. You realize how I can exploit this and blow it out all proportion.
Do you want me to repeat it?
Sure, with an exclamation point, absolutely. After each task, the participants were asked questions to judge their level of boredom. For instance, did it seem like time was passing slower than usual? And did you feel bored? Under this system, one task emerged as the most boring of all.
Okay, so the most boring task that we came up with is turning pegs or turning cogs.
This task was borrowed from an old experiment that asked lab subjects to turn little wooden pegs. Markey and her colleagues modified the task for a computer.
So specifically, what we had participants do is there were 8 circles on a screen, and every time they would click, it would rotate it a quarter turn. So they would rotate the first peg, and then they'd move to the second peg, and once they finished the 8 pegs, they'd start all over again.
Participants turn the pegs. The screen resets. Repeat. Repeat.
So it has this kind of Sisyphean element.
Now they had a quantifiably reliable way to make people bored. Markey and Lowenstein could test the scarce capacity theory of boredom. If boredom is a signal that a task isn't worth doing, what if they made the task a little bit more worthwhile? One obvious way was to use money.
We paid people a piece rate in terms of how many pegs they're turning.
Now, the stakes, we should say, were tiny. The researchers randomly split the participants in half. One group would earn just a half cent per peg turned, and the other got 2.5 cents. The most anyone could earn was $8. But people had to turn the pegs for several hours. They click, they turn, the screen resets, they click and turn some more.
And when you pay people more, sure enough, their level of boredom goes down. So that was one manipulation that we figured was very straightforward, but surprisingly hadn't been done before.
Another intervention was to make the task more challenging.
So we made the pegs a lot smaller and they kind of darted around, so you had to chase them.
Yeah, you had me at dart around it. Now it sounds like a game instead of a
task.
Yeah,
we tried to gamify it a little bit, so that effectively reduces boredom.
Now the researchers wanted to look at people's boredom levels when they thought they were being watched.
We told them that they were going to be monitored. So this was a lie. They weren't monitored in any way. But,
you guys are mean.
Oh, yeah. We told them, you're going to be monitored by different judges. They're going to watch your performance for about 10 seconds, and then they're going to give you a rating. So we found that reduced boredom, but we also did a manipulation check because we wanted to see, like, did you really think that someone was watching you? So we asked them at the very end of the study, and we said, you know, you got these ratings. Do you think there was a real person observing you? And the vast majority of our sample said no, and yet we still see the reduction in boredom. And then, it's really interesting. To address this, we thought, well, maybe we'll just give them objective feedback. So we made a little chart in the corner, and every 5 seconds, it would update on real time. And this did reflect how many pegs you were turning, and you kind of saw this line creeping up, or it would flatten out if you stopped. And we found that was really effective at reducing boredom as well.
But as Markey and her colleagues ran more experiments, there were things they expected to find, things that should prove the scarce capacity theory, that they did not find. In one manipulation, for instance, they thought they could make the peg-turning task less boring by telling participants that there was an altruistic angle.
I really wanted this to work, and I tried it numerous times, and I just couldn't get it to work. So at first we just told people, like, we want to study assembly line workers, and your work will really help us better understand and make conditions better for assembly line workers. No effect. And that was all just verbal. Then we said, we want to help children with ADHD. And we had a picture of a child on the screen and said, you know, like, your work on this task is just going to really help us better understand ADHD and attention. And we were really hoping that these altruistic interventions of helping other people would make a difference. And you know what? It just didn't.
Then the researchers tried to add some opportunity cost to this boring task. Subjects sitting at the computer were instructed to open their email program in a second tab. And then the researchers sent the subjects an email.
And we were hoping what this would do is it would make the task more boring because you kind of have this other thing tugging at your mind. And we didn't find that it made it more boring.
Which left them puzzled. According to the scarce capacity theory, adding something more interesting to do should make the task even less engaging. On the other hand, adding the altruism should make the task more engaging or less boring. This all makes George Loewenstein wonder if his scarce capacity theory really does help explain boredom. It might, he told us. It's just that he and his colleagues haven't been able to prove it yet. By the way, if you want to try all the boring tasks that Markey and her colleagues tested, you can find the link at Freakonomics.com. Coming up on Freakonomics Radio, the relationship between happiness, sex, and boredom, whether retirement leads to boredom. But first, we hear what you, Freakonomics Radio listeners, have to say about boredom.
Hello, Freakonomics Radio. My name is Margaret. I am 20 years old, and I am from Boston, Massachusetts.
My name is Ted Schmitz. I'm 27. I'm a valet in Arizona.
I really feel like I never really have time to be bored.
But in place of that, I've seen like a huge increase in anxiety or depression.
So what actually happens is if I find a time when I'm bored, I have this panic attack. I don't know what to do with myself.
I'm 65 years old, and I suspect that you're not going to find many people my age who are bored.
I really just want to be okay with being bored again.
The older you get, the less bored you are, because time just goes away.
Hi, my name is Sabrina. I am bored because I'm lazy.
I don't even understand the concept of boredom anymore as an adult.
I think the bored people will be the young ones.
I live in Bozeman, Montana, and I am 11 years old.
Hi, Freakonomics. My name is Ryan. I'm 28. I live in New York City.
If I ever felt bored, I would probably just jump for joy.
I've come to realize now I have 3 years sober, which I only mentioned because I used to think that in part I was getting high and drinking because I was bored. But in sobriety, I've come to see, and in part just as growing up, that boredom is a BS cover-up word for loneliness. There's no such thing as boredom.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio with your host, Stephen Dubner.
You asked about boredom. I'm just coming off of a long spell. I have a restaurant, and it's in the middle of Florida, but my family moves to the beach every summer. And when I'm at the beach, I'm just bored out of my mind. Like, all you can do is sit at the beach or swim at the beach, play with the kids a little bit, and I feel terrible because I know that I should be happy that I have a beach house and I'm at the beach all summer, but it gets really, really boring, and I'm not going to do it again. Next year, I'm going to come up with a plan. I don't know what that plan's going to be, but I'm going to have some sort of plan where I'm not bored all summer, out of my mind, with nothing to do. My name is Satchel, and I'm 47 years old.
What makes you bored? One way to answer that question is to ask a different question for which there are better data. What makes you happy and unhappy? Presumably, the stuff that makes us unhappy might also make us bored. Dan Gilbert, the psychologist who likes to give his research subjects electric shocks, he's done a lot of happiness research. He and his colleague Matt Killingsworth looked at data from more than 2,000 adults who said how happy they were during certain activities.
When you look at what people are doing and what they're thinking and how they're feeling as they go about living their everyday normal lives, you find that people are obviously very happy when they're doing things like eating or having sex. They're not very happy when they're doing things like working or commuting.
And what about when they're just resting, like Satchel Ray hanging out on the beach in Florida?
The answer is about as unhappy as when they're working or commuting.
But if you ask people what they see themselves doing when they retire, most of them talk about some version of rest.
Rest is the wrong answer, and we even know why from these data. When people rest, their minds wander. And when the mind wanders, it doesn't usually go to a happy place. People who are engaged in an activity are almost always happier than people who are not. So any retirement you plan that doesn't have you engaged in activities is probably not one that's going to make you happy.
Uh-oh. Does this mean we need to rethink retirement too?
I'm kind of in a staged retirement and will be playing a little bit more golf, I think, than I have.
That's Robert Willis. He's a professor of economics at the University of Michigan. Until recently, he directed the National Institute on Aging's Health and Retirement Study, or HRS.
Which is a very large longitudinal study that's designed to follow people and their spouses from the time they enter the study in their early 50s until they die. And it collects data on a wide range of economic, health, psychological, family, and other kinds of variables.
The HRS is nationally representative with data on about 20,000 people so far. And it's conducted in a way that lets researchers measure the impact of retirement at different ages. The HRS is also the model for similar studies in many other countries, which makes for good international comparisons.
The intent all the way along was to kind of ensure that the data sets were as close as possible.
If you look at international retirement ages in the late 1950s, Willis says, you won't notice much variance.
The labor force participation rates of older men were very similar across all of the European countries, the United States, Japan, and so forth.
We're talking here about men aged 60 to 65. But fast forward to the 1990s, and now there's a big split.
So that in Japan, labor force participation had remained really quite high, and the U.S. participation had fallen some, but not dramatically. But in some countries, most notably the Netherlands and Belgium, male participation rates at those ages had fallen from something on the order of about 70% in the early period down to about 20% by the mid-1990s.
The difference was almost entirely accounted for not by individuals' choices about when to retire, but retirement policies.
The U.S. has a relatively neutral system of taxes and pensions and the like in terms of how long people work. So, for example, the Social Security payments that you receive are higher if you delay retirement than if you retire as early as you can. And France, on the other hand, has a lot of strong incentives to retire early, and people, in fact, do retire quite a bit earlier than in the United States.
For a researcher, these differences create a sort of natural experiment that can be used to help understand how early retirement affects people. And that's exactly what Robert Willis and a colleague, the economist Susan Rowader, decided to do. They wanted to learn about the relationship between retirement and mental cognition. Their instrument of choice was a memory test.
A test that asks people to listen to a variety of very simple words.
This is an exercise that's already built into those big longitudinal retirement studies.
Words like bird and tree.
Lake, army, car.
Truck.
And in Italy, France, or Germany?
There are, of course, words in Italian or French or German.
Camion.
Uccello.
Lastwagen.
But psychometric techniques have been used to make sure that they provide comparable measures of memory.
Baum.
Albero.
Oiseau.
Army. Participants hear a list of words and are asked to immediately repeat the words to the person interviewing them.
Voiture.
Tree.
Militaire.
Lago.
And then about 5 or 10 minutes later in the interviewer will say, "Oh, remember those words that I read to you a while back? How many of those can you repeat back to me now?"
Bird.
Esercito.
Camion.
And so the cognitive test we have is a memory test of immediate and delayed word recall.
So what did Willis and Rowader find?
The countries that had laws that led people to retire early, there was a really quite substantial effect on people's cognitive ability in this memory domain.
A downward effect, that is. Study participants from the U.S. and other countries where older people are more likely to still work did much better than participants from countries like France and Italy, where older adults are less likely to work. In the U.S., more than 50% of 60 to 64-year-olds are still in the workforce. Willis calls this cognitive decline the mental retirement effect.
The basic idea is that if you exercise your mind and you're in a stimulating environment and you're motivated to use your mind, that you'll maintain your cognitive abilities. Conversely, if you are in an unstimulating environment, don't exercise your mind, the effect would be negative on cognition. So in that sense, it's very much like the idea that physical exercise leads to physical fitness.
Willis is fairly confident the effect is causal, that retirement leads to lower cognitive levels. But as to the why,
we don't really understand the underlying mechanisms very well.
We asked Willis whether boredom might have anything to do with the mental retirement effect.
I must confess that when you called me that I had not really thought about boredom apart from occasionally thinking about my own boredom.
But he agreed that boredom is a plausible factor to explain the mental retirement effect. So he did some digging for us, and he found that the HRS, the Health and Retirement Study, was already thinking about this.
There was a boredom question.
It's part of a series of psychological measures that participants are given every 2 years.
So it said, during the past 30 days, to what degree did you feel bored? Not at all, a little, moderately, quite a bit, very much.
Now keep in mind, this is a survey for older Americans, 50 and up. Only about a quarter of these respondents reported feeling bored moderately to very much.
The very much was only about 3%. So somebody who's really very bored, that's not a majority status by any means, but it's also a fairly significant number say they have experienced some boredom.
Willis got curious about the correlations he might find in these data.
And I discovered, for example, that being married, people who are married are significantly less bored than people who are not married. So that kind of goes to the idea that part of boredom, at least, is a matter of interactions with others, probably. And people who are not married probably have fewer interactions with others. Education is an important variable. The less educated are substantially more bored than the well-educated. So people with less than high school, have about 25% of them are bored, and that falls to about 14% for the people with college degrees or graduate degrees. Work status, there are about 20% are bored among workers and about 25% among non-workers.
And because respondents take the survey every couple of years, Willis could see how their boredom answers changed after retirement.
There's really quite a strong negative effect. That is, the people who were working in 2008, who subsequently did not work in 2012, were slightly more bored than they had been. On the other hand, the people who were working in 2008, who are continuing to work in 2012, had a substantial decline in boredom.
None of this surprised Willis very much, nor are these findings particularly robust.
It's far from proving anything, so I wouldn't really want to go further than that.
But it was consistent with his earlier research on the mental retirement effect and how that might be driven by a lack of stimulation, which naturally leads us to circle back to the question we began with today about worker productivity generally and how big of a problem boredom may be.
We just don't know that much about how boredom affects people's productivity.
That's Amanda Markey, the boredom researcher.
Certainly there's the intuition that it's got to slow you down or make you browse the internet or make you maybe do other things that aren't as helpful.
We're thinking about a new project about the role of boredom in the economy.
And that is Heather Schofield.
I'm a development economist.
Schofield is with the University of Pennsylvania and the Center for Global Development. She does a lot of work in India, and the new boredom research project she's thinking about concerns Indian farmers.
So you're very busy when you're planting things, and you're very busy when you're harvesting.
But agriculture being seasonal, there's also a lot of downtime. The ensuing boredom, Schofield says, may affect worker productivity.
Where people who basically don't have a lot going on, keeping them occupied and keeping their brain moving, go into something of a stupor. And it becomes very hard to get anything done.
And that stupor, Schofield believes, can have a compounding effect.
There's actually very good data in agronomy saying if you weed your plants maybe twice or three times in season instead of once, you'll actually increase your yields dramatically. But maybe you end up in this kind of mental retirement state because there's not a lot going on, and it's hard to get yourself out the door to weed the plants because you can always do it the next day. So basically then, the idea is that this mental retirement or this boredom may actually in some ways decrease people's output even more. And conversely, if you actually get people to work more, it may crowd in labor rather than crowding out labor, which would be pretty surprising. So that is to say, if I get you to work more, it would actually make you work even more because it gets you out of this state of kind of boredom or mental retirement.
Heather Schofield doesn't know yet whether this is true. We'll have to revisit that research down the road. But it does make sense, doesn't it? That boredom can feed on itself and make you even more bored, just as productivity can also feed on itself. So if there's even a slight chance that boredom does lower productivity, shouldn't we think about alleviating boredom in the workplace?
I think there are probably some really cheap interventions that you could do.
Amanda Markey, you will recall, ran all those experiments trying to reduce boredom by paying people, by turning their boring task into a game. What ideas does she have for fighting workplace boredom?
One would be a competition and recognition. We actually haven't tested competition, but I imagine what that does is that, you know, all of a sudden now you're kind of doing a different task because you're trying to do it as fast and quickly and efficiently as possible. So I think that would be pretty effective.
But remember, Markey now teaches high school algebra.
I think I would go with totally gamifying a school. Things like that immediate feedback, like always having that progress bar in terms of are you learning, are you not? How do you compare with others? And I think this would achieve the short-term goal of having students learn subjects. I really worry, though, if it's going to make kind, hardworking, persistent students, which is ultimately what we want.
Angela Duckworth, the Penn psychologist who used to teach high school math, argues that boredom, for all its obvious downsides, may serve a useful purpose.
We need that feedback to say, like, hey, you might not be learning very much right now. You know, notice that you feel this boredom and then see where that thinking leads you. You know, now what do you think? Now that you've realized that you're bored, what do you think is really going on?
So is boredom whether you're a teacher looking out at your classroom of students or whether you're just a person sitting there thinking about, well, I feel bored and I'm going to try to relieve my boredom and click around on the web and all of a sudden it's an hour and I feel worse in the end? Can boredom in either of those cases be what we might consider a really useful signal, something that we should act on, but we don't really act on in necessarily a positive way for the most part?
Yeah, I generally think, I mean, if you want my secret view of like what success in life really is from a psychologist standpoint.
I want your secret view of like, success in
all right,
life, definitely.
So I'm just going to go out on a limb here and say it. It's not that I have like all the, you know, a mountain of evidence and so forth. But I think it really comes down to this. Every successful person that I've ever interviewed, and I do a lot of interviewing of successful, you know, gold medalists and CEOs of Fortune 100 companies and so forth. Every single one is extraordinarily metacognitive. By that, I mean that they are able to reflect on their own emotions, their own thoughts, and their own behaviors. They're sort of able to step outside themselves and say, what am I doing? What just happened there? Is that something that I liked? Did I not like it? What can I do to kind of go back into the situation and do it differently next time? 201, I would say that is characteristic of successful people. And so therefore, if you're bored, I think it's a very healthy thing to say to yourself, I noticed that I spent 4 hours today at work. You know, my husband said this to me actually last night. He said, you know, I realized that I really hate reading construction contracts. So he's a real estate developer. And he had this moment of metacognitive insight that he found this like the most boring part of his job. And then what he did was he like acknowledging that boredom. He's like, you know, they have to get done, right? And they actually have to get reviewed very carefully because otherwise I can lose a lot of money. So he decided to call a construction lawyer and he delegated a bunch of this stuff and he felt terrific about it. I think not that every kid can delegate reading their homework assignment or delegate memorizing their time scale. You can't always do that. But that moment of metacognitive insight to know thyself and then to say, okay, well, you know, given the situation, what could and should I do about it? I think that is truly crucial.
In pursuit of greater metacognitive insight, I'd like to introduce you to one of the sharpest scholars I know. His name is Ed Glaser. He's an economist at Harvard. He's what you might call an urban environmentalist. Not long ago, he wrote a paper called The Supply of Environmentalism. What does he mean by that?
I actually do believe that almost all environmentalists are motivated by relatively benign forces and that they're trying to do good for the world. And I do not think on net that environmentalism isn't a good force. I believe on net it is.
There's a but, isn't there? You're just waiting for the but.
But I do think that inevitably we move things down to sound bites, we move things down to simple implications. And sometimes these just mean that we get results that are less than perfect.
That's coming up after the break.
From WNYC Studios, this is Freakonomics Radio. Here's your host, Stephen Dubner.
Ed Glaser believes that most environmentalism is based on good intentions, but that for a number of reasons, environmental messaging can be counterproductive. All right, let's get specific. What's the greenest thing you can think of off the top of your head? All right, maybe walking or riding a bike instead of using something with an engine. Maybe that's the very greenest thing that comes to mind. What's the second or third? What's the 19th greenest thing you can think of? Maybe it's bamboo? Yeah, bamboo. Now, here's a commercial for bamboo from an Australian retailer called Etitude. The commercial features a talking panda, and as the panda tells us, bamboo is pretty green.
Bamboo is great for the earth because once it's cut down, it grows back quickly, which means it's a great renewable resource. It also doesn't need any pesticides or fertilizers to grow and soaks up nitrates from the soil, which makes for a clean and happy earth. It's great at absorbing carbon.
In terms of the conversations around bamboo, what's surprising is that it seems like people really fixated on that single attribute, that it grows fast. And in some ways, we should know better than that.
That's Catherine Fernals with Dovetail Partners. They're an environmental think tank in Minneapolis. Dovetail published a report called Bamboo Flooring, Environmental Silver Bullet or Faux Savior. Just because bamboo grows fast, Fernals says, does not make it a miracle crop.
There's all kinds of things that grow fast. Corn grows fast, and we've heard all of the negative impacts of some types of ethanol production. So that's what's surprising, is with how sophisticated environmental conversations have become, too often still we just go back to single attributes and we forget to look at the whole context of how things are produced.
The context of bamboo production, Fernald says, is a bit more complicated.
Most bamboo, to be economical for an export market, is going to be cultivated in an intensive way. And so that generally means monoculture. It's going to be one species, you know, or maybe a few different species, but all bamboo in a cultivated area, and most likely with intensive inputs like fertilizers and chemicals to boost that productivity.
So what else do we not talk about when we talk about bamboo? Well, most bamboo products are imported from Asia, where increased demand can lead to deforestation and other unsustainable practices. And just because something is made from bamboo, or promoted as being made from bamboo, doesn't necessarily make it so green. Turning all that bamboo into all those products means going through the typical manufacturing processes, which involve plenty of additives and hazardous chemicals. The Federal Trade Commission fined 4 national retailers $1 million for falsely marketing fabrics made from bamboo as environmentally friendly. The FTC, in a bout of cleverness, had a warning for consumers. Don't get bamboozled. This brings us back to Ed Glaser's point. The fact is that it's easy to be bamboozled because it feels so good to be told that the things we like to do aren't bad for the environment, for our kids and grandkids. We all want clean air and leafy forests and pristine lakes, which means there's a lot of demand for the supply of environmentalism, not all of which, unfortunately, is as green as it sounds. Here's Ed Glaser again.
I walked through 3 cases in the paper about things that have been clearly part of environmental campaigns. And 2 of them, I think, I was just being less than perfect, recycling and hybrid cars. And 1 of which I think of as being in some cases downright counterproductive, which is local opposition to new construction, particularly in greater San Francisco or greater California.
I'd like to ask you now to just back up and give me a very brief thumbnail of each of those. So talk to me about the less than perfect outcome of recycling, for instance.
So recycling, this is an old idea among economists. Darby is the person who's associated with it. The point being that what you care about is the number of trees in the world, you actually want people to use more paper rather than less, because in the long run, the demand for paper determines the stock of trees, because fundamentally this is a renewable resource and you have to plant more trees in order to get more paper. Now, that isn't true if the paper is being produced from first growth forests. If paper feels more like we're fishing from a common pool, that isn't true. But that's not actually how paper is produced in the U.S. It's actually produced in these renewable forests. So pushing people to recycle more doesn't necessarily do anything good in terms of forests. And indeed, if you want more trees, use more paper. Now, the flip side of that, and the reason why that's a little bit too glib, is that, of course, there still is potential for energy savings in recycling. There still are other potential advantages from recycling. And anyway, I'm just talking about paper. I'm not talking about plastic or any of the other things. So I wouldn't try and say that I'm trying to beat the band against recycling. But it is clear that many of the reasons why recycling is – how recycling is sold, often with this, you know, save a tree, don't recycle, get it – you know, get it backwards, that actually it's the people who are using more paper that are actually encouraging people to supply more trees. And it's similar to the point about vegetarianism and the number of animals, right? I mean, if we wanted to make sure there were no pigs on this world, we wouldn't start eating a lot of pigs. We would stop eating pigs.
Another classic recycling argument is, you know, let's say paper or plastic cup versus ceramic mug. And it's held by many people that it's somewhat close to a sin to use a disposable cup when you have a ceramic one at your disposal. And yet you have to consider the energy associated with the ceramic mug, not only making it and how long it lasts and so on, but every time you wash it, the hot water it consumes and where that water, how that water is produced, where's the electricity come from, the detergent in the drainage and so on, using the water with which to wash it, the time involved and so on, versus throwing away a paper cup. So What do you know about that beyond what I just blathered, and where do you stand on that?
So I think I'm not going to take a stand specifically on recycled cups versus not, but I know that what, as economists, we would tell people is to, you know, perfectly calculate the full environmental consequences of everything that you're doing and then make the appropriate choice taking that into account. We also know that that's an absurd thing for people to say, and part of the recycling story is that we boil things down to a soundbite, i.e. please recycle, and as a result, we don't necessarily get always the perfect outcome. So it may be that most of the time using the ceramic cup is actually the right thing to do, but there surely are cases where it's not, and we don't have any ability to nuance because we're following a bright line rule.
And we could go on and on, electric hand dryers in a bathroom versus paper towels and probably 100 other examples. The bottom line is, I certainly don't know. I'm guessing you don't know. Somebody probably knows if they take a lot of time to figure out each case, but your point is a larger one, yes?
Yes, it is. It's that the because this works through this public market, you inevitably get towards simple bright line rules, you know, some of which can be imperfect.
Obviously, we're all susceptible to marketing messages, but just because someone says something doesn't make it true. For example, I am a cat. I am a cat. I am a cat.
Meow.
Right. I'm not a cat. To Ed Glaser, one of the trickiest environmental messages of the moment concerns electric cars.
Now, one of the things that's interesting about cars is it harkens back to perhaps the greatest hit of environmental and energy economics, which is the Jevons paradox, which is Stanley Jevons' great observation that between 1750 and the age of the new common engine and 1850, steam engines in the United Kingdom had become wildly more efficient, much better at moving things with smaller and smaller amounts of coal being burned. Now, you might have thought that this would create a radical reduction in the use of coal, and indeed all fears that the UK would mine itself out would have vanished in the rise of all this energy efficient engines. But of course, the opposite was happening, that what those more efficient engines were doing, what the age of Boulton and Watt was creating, was a whole world built around the steam engine that meant that instead of using less coal, we were using more and more coal because of the behavioral response. And I think one of the reasons why Jevons is so popular is because he really focuses on what economists care about most, which is the behavioral response to changes in conditions. So just think about that. The Jevons paradox is closely tied to how we think about CAFE standards for cars or other forms of energy efficiency.
So you're implying here, let's say we could convert our internal combustion engine fleet right now of however many hundreds of millions of vehicles that is, with a few hybrids and electrics thrown in around the edges, to an entirely electric fleet tomorrow. Let's say we could push a magic switch. Your warning is that because the electric car would seem to be so environmentally friendly, it will produce an oversupply of, well, it would people would drive a whole lot more. Yes, that's the fear?
Well, it doesn't even have to do with because it seems environmentally friendly. It's because it's so much cheaper. Now, what's interesting about electric cars is that because they use a totally different technology, they both reduce the cost of driving a mile and also they change the environmental footprint. They reduce both of which is a good thing, but they reduce the cost per mile by a lot. Substantially more than they reduce the environmental footprint. Now, by comparison, the carbon emissions related to driving is a much less substantial reduction. It is a substantial reduction, but much less than that. So you're pushing so strongly on the cost that it's much easier to imagine that an all-electric fleet could have a big enough rebound effect to offset it. Now, I'm not sure I believe that, but it is something actually to worry about in terms of the impact of this.
Your third example in the paper has to do with development regulations. Can you talk us through that?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So here is probably the area in which I both am least convinced by the pure benevolence of the persuaders and most convinced that the effects are actually counterproductive from an environmental point of view. So the point is that there are certain parts of the country, like San Francisco, that are intrinsically incredibly green. If you just think about the climate of San Francisco, it requires very little heating in the winter and very little cooling in the summer. And parts of the older areas, the core dense areas, are also endowed with excellent public transit. And as a result, you know, building more housing there is about the greenest spot in the country in which you could do so. Now, you would think that environmentalists who were interested in minimizing America's carbon footprint would therefore be beating the band to increase the amount of production around the San Francisco Bay. Because indeed, it's just that production that will ensure that we live in an area that is environmentally sensitive rather than an area that is environmentally difficult. But of course, the opposite is the case. For 45 years, San Francisco has been a center for environmental activism that was focused on restricting building in greater San Francisco. And it became increasingly difficult to build in San Francisco. The Supreme Court of California also helped with the Friends of Mammoth case, which required an environmental impact review for any large-scale development in California. And those environmental impact reviews are intrinsically flawed because what they do is they ask about what the local environmental impact is of the project, but not the global environmental impact of not building the project. Because every time you say no to a project in greater San Francisco, it means that you're saying yes to a project somewhere else, right? I mean, the rate of household formation in the U.S. doesn't get to be determined in San Francisco. They just get to determine whether or not it happens there. So if you turn off building in Berkeley, it turns on outside of Houston. It turns on outside of Las Vegas. And in order to ask yourself whether or not this local environmentalism is good environmentalism, you have to compare the carbon emissions associated with building in Houston versus building in San Francisco. And I think once you start doing that, the oppositions of local building in you know, coastal California look like they have it backwards.
So that is fascinating and it makes sense. On the other hand, we can't really, on that kind of environmental issue, we can't profess to be that surprised, can we? Because this is basic NIMBYism, isn't it? Yes, of course I'm an environmentalist. Unless my environmentalism requires me to do something right here that affects me in a poor way. Now, some people are incredibly selfless and altruistic, but probably most of us kind of constantly juggle. We want what's good for the world, but we especially want what's good for ourselves and our families. So can you really lump in, let's say, that kind of anti-development fervor with the same kind of broad environmental messaging that's maybe more generally about energy or generally about recycling or generally about, you know, the advantages of one kind of energy versus another?
Well, I think you're exactly right in that it is precisely because it is motivated by fairly personal issues rather than a generic altruism that it has been more likely to not be to the environmental good. I think that's exactly right. In terms of lumping it together, I think all of this stuff is on a continuum. So I don't think of this as being radically different. I think, you know, if you ask my neighbors who are opposing development for allegedly environmental reasons, they would think that they are thinking globally and acting locally and part of exactly the same crusade as – and in some sense, the job of the economist is to create something of a hypocrisy tax, right? To say you can oppose the development, but you can't pretend you're doing good for the environment. You have to at least admit that what you're trying to do is to make your own commute a little bit easier or to not have to deal with the construction on your street corner. You're not allowed to pretend that you're doing good for the world by doing it.
Gosh, that's a great way of putting it because I think that's a struggle that most right-minded people have. And let's assume for the moment that 100% of us are right-minded. We want what's good for ourselves and our families and the ones we love. And we want to punish everyone else not very much, right? Let's assume right. That's the case. And yet, I guess what I'm taking from hearing you talk is that the message of environmentalism is too often the bright line or the black mm-hmm. versus white that doesn't allow for that contradiction to kind of live within us.
I think that's probably right, and that we should probably be most aware of environmental messages when they are sold by people who have an obvious personal interest in it.
That makes sense, doesn't it? Follow the money and follow the incentives. Like earlier, when we were talking about bamboo, the anti-bamboo sentiment came from Dovetail Partners, which is, quoting itself, a trusted source of environmental information. Now, their arguments against bamboo sound perfectly legitimate, but we should note that among Dovetail Partners' many sponsors are the American Wood Council, the Forest Landowners Association, the kind of folks who might not be crazy about all that Asian bamboo being turned into floorboards and toilet paper. And if you think the incentives get murky in marketing, just look at how environmental ideas are handled in politics. You remember when ethanol made from corn was thought to be the next great green energy breakthrough? Ethanol turned out not to be as green as promised, and I'm sure you'll be shocked to know some of the politicians who subsidized it had their own incentives. Al Gore, back when he was vice president, was a big supporter of ethanol subsidies for corn farmers, but a few years ago,
at an energy conference in Athens, Gore admitted that it had been a bad policy. So why'd he support it? "One of the reasons I made that mistake," he said, "is that I paid particular attention to the farmers in my home state of Tennessee, and I had a certain fondness for the farmers in the state of Iowa because I was about to run for president." Hey, give the man 2 points for being honest at least, right? Now if we can only get that talking panda to come clean about bamboo. I'm Stephen Dubner, and that was Freakonomics Radio. Thanks for listening. We will be back next week. If you just can't wait that long, you can get our entire Freakonomics Radio podcast archive at freakonomics.com or at iTunes, where you can also subscribe.